Hello and welcome to I'll Have What She's Having, a food and drink podcast from me, Sophie Wybird.
And me, Hannah Crosby. Every week, Sophie and I sit down to dinner. She makes a dish, I pair a wine, and we put the world to rights. This week, we pair courgettes and Oakleshield tart with an Essex Chardonnay.
And we talk starting a business and mental health journeys with chef patron Dara Klein. Hello! We're back, and today we have another very special guest. Hannah, who have we got?
I am so excited to say that this week we welcome chef and all-round top babe, Dara Klein.
Yay!
Dara grew up in Emilia-Romagna and Wellington, where she spent most of her time in the restaurant her mum ran. She's lived in Melbourne and New York before eventually settling in London, who can blame her, and embarking on a career slinging pans in some of the city's best restaurants. She recently opened Tiella at the Compton Arms, cooking joyful and hearty Italian food, which we can attest to because we ate there recently and fucking loved it.
It was brilliant.
It celebrates her heritage and you should all go. Welcome, Dara.
Ciao. Thank
Ciao,
you.
Ciao,
buongiorno.
Buongiorno.
It's so nice to have you here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
We've been plotting this for so long and it's such a treat to have you.
We have. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
We came to Tiella a few weeks ago when you had had a bit of a like classic kitchen disaster.
Yes.
But you still managed to pull off a really phenomenal meal for us.
Yes,
what happened?
That, do you know what? That was maybe the most challenging day that we had so far.
How long had you been open for at that point?
Almost 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you know what? We had the smoothest 5 weeks at the start. And like I've been in this business since I was seven and I was like, it's never this smooth. Like something's coming. And then we just had like some short staffing issues, some maintenance all going wrong on the same weekend. So I think I saw you on the Wednesday.
Yeah.
And the previous Sunday, the boiler for the pub had broken.
No.
And then that Wednesday that we came in, it was our first time prepping all together. Actually, no, that wasn't the week that Alex came back. We had the dishwasher break and the sink break on the same day. And so we lost a few hours from our prep day. And anyways, we pulled it off. You always do, but it can sometimes be a bit spicy in the moment.
Yeah, in the morning you're like, I want to die. This is too much. Let me go to bed.
Pretty much.
But we had this incredible cuttlefish ragu. With
I think
Tony
that was the standout dish for both of us.
Standout dish for both of us. There was also that the penne with the anchovies on top.
Fabulous.
Honestly, yeah, 10 out of 10. If you guys are in London or London adjacent or fancy coming into London for a really nice meal, go to Tiella at the Compton Arms. The Compton Arms is also a great pub.
I think I was about to say it's also a fabulous location because, yeah, it's a pub garden to all intents and purposes, but it's kind of only like two tables thick, so it's like quite thin and the garden kind of like snakes around the kitchen, so it's kind of almost like this goldfish bowl that you can look into and see Dara and her chefs doing amazing stuff.
It's such a special pub, like it's got so much character. I was actually sleeping there last weekend because there's a flat upstairs.
Oh my God,
and
great.
The guys that live upstairs one has just now left working the pub. They were at Glastonbury, so I was looking after the cat. And so I got to sleep in the pub Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And already, like, I've loved that pub from basically as soon as I moved to London, I started going. There's so many quirks. I think it was built in the 1500s. And it's, you can feel the history when you're in there. Like, it's definitely slightly haunted, but with good ghosts.
Okay.
Sunday night, I was by myself in the pub. I was like, oh, I don't know. I can, what's this that I'm feeling? But I think they're cheeky. And actually, in the morning, I woke up and the sour beer tap had been like, it was leaking all night, like almost like a ghost had pulled it.
They just wanted some pints.
Oh, do you know what I mean? They're thirsty.
They're after a good time.
Yeah. There's a pun in there somewhere. I'm going to go silent for 10 minutes while I think of it.
But yeah, it's a fabulous, like, it's such a beautiful building. And like, it is very intimate, very low ceilings. The garden is small, but also if you're looking for like a slightly more like a romantic dinner date, the Snug, which is the other side of the pub where you can book, which is the small dining room to the left of the bar, that's also really lovely. And then we also have tables for walk-ins as well, just in the main kind of entrance of the pub.
It's such a good spot.
If you want outside, it is the spot of the summer.
Yeah.
I think we had such a brilliant
Find
time.
Us there.
I'm actually going tonight.
Are you?
Oh, not to eat, but I am going to meet a friend for a drink.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll literally see you
there. Hannah was like, I've somehow ended up stalking Dara and I'm going to Compton Arms tonight.
Stalk away.
So you spent a lot of your childhood and adult life in Wellington. What is the New Zealand equivalent of a pub?
Yeah, do you know what? I say this all the time. It's almost funny that the pub format hasn't really taken off in New Zealand. I think the equivalent to a pub in New Zealand, you have a lot of like these places that are kind of cafes, but they're also beer gardens and they're also kind of restaurants. Like they'll be open morning to night and operate as both like a cafe, a bar and a restaurant.
Oh, great.
That are quite family.
I think
friendly.
That probably in the UK we keep things quite separate. It's very rare that you'll have like an all-day space. There'll be like a pub that's open in the evening thinking, and a bakery that's open in the
I'm
day.
I'm thinking of totally. This place, and I could be making up lies, but I am thinking about this place in Wellington, which I think it's called the Southern Cross, which was, in my idea, quite similar to what a pub is over here. Very casual, laid back. But pubs in New Zealand, they're not, I mean, to be completely honest, they're much more like working class spaces that, like, I don't know, you don't see like a huge array of society.
Mm. Okay, gotcha.
The pub format, I don't know, it didn't translate exactly in New Zealand to how it is over here.
So what do you do after work?
You go to the bar.
I mean,
I think you say pub, but it's like there are pubs in New Zealand which are closer to what a pub is over here.
Yeah.
But they're not as like, I think you just say you're going to go, yeah, you go to the bar. Do you know what? It's been like 5 years since I've been back. I don't remember.
You're so acclimatized to UK life.
Do you know,
now.
I don't remember life anymore in New Zealand.
Well, what about New Zealand food culture?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty awesome what's happened. So we moved to New Zealand when I was like almost about to turn 7.
Oh, nice.
And not having any family from there. And so it was really like a complete new placement. I had no idea what it was going to be like. And I think the New Zealand that I first arrived to culinarily is very different to what it is now. I think the food scene in New Zealand has developed hugely, especially for being so far away from a lot of the world. But yeah, I think, I mean, to be honest, like I can think of places in Auckland and Wellington, which are the two cities that I've really only lived in. And Auckland's got a really great independent sort of food scene. But yeah, like I said, I actually really only started getting into food quite seriously just before moving over here. So I actually look forward to going back to New Zealand and embracing that because, to be honest, after growing up in a restaurant in New Zealand, I think in my like late teens and early adulthood, I shied away from it a bit.
Yeah, but like, you do that with the things that your parents do. They're really cringe and boring.
Yeah.
Dara, your mum was a big restaurateur in Wellington.
Yeah.
What was that like growing up in that kind of environment?
How long have we got?
Good
how
good
long
question.
Have we got? It was everything. It was terrifying, stressful, wonderful, exhilarating, really horrible. You know, I think I don't know if this is true, but for me, growing up in a restaurant meant that like my mum and dad were like never home.
Yeah.
When I say they were never home, like they were never home.
Yeah.
Like
you were in the restaurant
exactly.
instead.
Exactly. And both, so we first opened what's called Arosticheria, which is like a hot deli essentially, in a suburb that was close to where we lived and close to my primary school. And that was the first iteration. And mum and dad were holding, they brought the slow food movement over to Wellington as well.
Amazing.
And they were holding like monthly dinners and the shop was takeaway. So you could go there and get like fresh bread or fresh pasta or ready hot meals to take home. And then they were holding these kind of monthly dinners and word was spreading. And people, mum and dad were having like illegal dinners in the deli.
Oh my God.
And then they were like, okay, maybe we could actually open a restaurant. So dad was doing front of house and mum was doing back of house. My dad, I mean, he's a mysterious man. He like was a salesman forever, but studied linguistics, but ended up in hospitality. And then mum was doing all the cooking. And then, yeah, they opened the restaurant and that was kind of more central in Wellington, close to the Parliament District, which was, you know, a 20-minute drive from our house. So really from age like, how old was I? 12 to 18, you know, if I wanted to be around mum and dad, I would have to go to the restaurant. And
was it open all days of the week?
It was shut, I think, Sunday, Monday, I think. And then it was back open either Tuesday or Wednesday. And yeah, it was, I'm really grateful for that life because I think it exposed me to something that obviously I love so much now. In the moment, I really wished to have like parents who worked 9 to 5. But I think most children or, you know, when you grow up, you always want what you can't have.
Totally.
But yeah.
Do you think it was something to do with that, which is why it took you till a bit later in your life to get into cooking professionally?
Absolutely.
That is not to say that you're an old lady in the slightest.
Already said that for the record. Let the record show that Dara's already
said
that.
I'm an old hag, yes.
but it was kind of a career change for you in a way, wasn't
100%.
It?
100%. I was 28. I mean, mum and dad give me shit about this all the time. They're like, you always said you never wanted to be a chef. I worked in restaurants all the way through uni because I studied in Australia. When I lived in the States, I also worked front of house. And even when I first moved back to New Zealand, I did a little bit of front of house. So I was always in restaurants, but I never, ever, ever hand on heart perceived a job in kitchens to be anything to do with my future. and it really happened quite, I don't know. It sounds really cheesy, but it's like fate was like, okay, I've had enough. You're doing this now. Like, I know this is not what you think you're going to do, but I'm going to step in because it happened very kind of randomly how I got into cooking.
What was your path looking like before then? Yeah, I want to
know.
Okay, full story.
All right, so I went to uni for creative writing and cinema studies.
Amazing.
And then I got really into theatre and acting while I was at uni. And I graduated from Melbourne Uni, and then I got into drama school in Sydney. Mm. Kind of like the Australian equivalent to like RADA, so very, very intensive. Wow.
I think I know the one that you mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty funny. I auditioned for like 3 months and then I got in. I only lasted 8 months because it was really like being in the army but for actors. And I just hated having people tell me what I had to do all day long.
Yeah.
And I think I was ready to just not
study.
What
was the name of it again?
NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art.
I always find this kind of thing so interesting because I think I did see like people that had been to NIDA.
Yeah, it's an epic place. And I really wanted it at the time. Like we had to do, it was like close to like 3 months of auditions. They take like 5,000 of us.
That's so intense.
And they choose 20 of us to get in the course. And I was really convinced like I want to be an actor. And then I really hated the course. But I think I was just ready to not study because I'd already done it for 3 years. And then I moved back to Melbourne for a few months and worked in a restaurant and saved some money. And then I moved to New York, which is very close to where my dad's from.
Where's your dad from?
New Jersey, baby.
Oh,
West Orange.
Is he proper Italian-American?
Well, my American side is actually like Ashkenazi Jewish.
Ah.
So it's just my mum's side that's Italian.
Okay.
So my American side is like very like East Coast Jewish.
The Klein, of course.
Yeah.
It all makes sense.
I moved to New York and I worked front of house in a restaurant. I was having like a gap year because I'd gone straight from high school to uni. And then to be honest, my life kind of took a real turn. And while I was in New York, I got diagnosed with bipolar and I had like a really major manic episode and was hospitalized for quite a while. And then I had to move back to New Zealand and really take care of myself.
Word. Yeah.
And my life was pretty rocky for a few years, kind of having one episode after another.
Trying to figure out like the right balance of how to...
What was it like getting the diagnosis? Because some people find it freeing and some people find it like, oh God.
I mean, yeah, to be totally transparent, like, so my mum has like pretty severe mental health issues. She's avoided diagnoses her whole life, but I'm pretty sure we have a very similar thing.
Yeah.
For the first 4 years, I really struggled with it. And there were other things happening in my life that were quite destabilizing, but I thought that there was another way around things. And I played doctor a few times and would, I just really struggled with the medication, to be honest. Like it was, I felt like it was like dulling parts of me. And so I had a very, very rocky, turbulent time between sort of age like 23 to 27. But during that time, like when I went back to New Zealand, this is when I got into like office jobs. So my dad and my doctor were kind of like, you need some routine, you need some stability. And so I started working as like admin assistant or like marketing assistant for like short-term contract jobs. And you like name the industry and I tried it, like government, like an ad agency, a creative arts trust. Like I was just trying to find something that stuck and I was so miserable. And I was having this like existential crisis of like, this can't be what my life is. And then fast forward to like 2017, and unfortunately I had another episode, but I was up in Auckland at the time, or just north of Auckland, close to where my mum was. And I was in a very, very small beach town when I got unwell. And I was like, you know what? When I sort of came to and I was in hospital, I was like, I think I actually need some time off and I need some time away from the grind of life. And so I actually stayed in that town, which is called, well, it was Ahipara, which is just near like, it's in Northland, which is like the most kind of remote north part of New Zealand. And I lived with this amazing, quite wacky Dutch beekeeper for 7 months. And I was on the dole. I was just not working. And I gave myself time off.
Resting
and like letting my mind and my soul kind of heal. And that's actually when I got really into cooking because I wasn't working. And so I was trying to really fill my time with practical, positive things. And I had an incredible garden at my disposal. I was learning how to beekeep. I felt very connected to land and food. And then I moved to Auckland after that, close to where my mum was. And I, again, got an office job because Auckland's quite an expensive city and I needed to make money. I didn't want to be in hospitality. But I was really cooking and a lot in my downtime. And that's when I sort of said to my mum, I was like, hey, do you want to like hold a supper club? Like you're pretty much retired. All we do is cook together. Should we try and like do this? Kind of as just like a fun idea. And that's what we did. And that was the start of all of this. And that was 2018, I think like April.
That's incredible. Mm. That's amazing. It's happened so quickly.
It's a really important thing that you've touched on, I think, just like the healing powers of cooking and feeling really connected to that side of things, to nature and to the processes of pulling together a really delicious plate of food.
We talked earlier today about cooking as a process that you can use as part of the healing process.
Totally.
Cooking as part of healing.
Oh, it's massive. I think it really put my life together, I have to be honest. Like it really, it was always, food was always the main kind of pillar in my family life and in my like identity, really. It was like the glue, but I never perceived it to be a possible career path because I saw my mum have it so hard.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
it's off-putting, I'm sure.
It was really off. And she was running a restaurant in, you know, the early 2000s where it was even more difficult for women and, you know, with all her mental health issues. And I was like, well, I could not deal with that kind of stress. But life had other plans. I'm very happy it did.
And here you are. Yeah. And it's all been leading up to this podcast recording.
It has.
It's really interesting the like different relationships that different generations have with their mental health and discussing it. Mm. I know that it's something that our generation are much more literate and comfortable discussing and like really exploring within themselves how they really feel about things and how and why their minds go to places.
Yeah.
But our parents' generations don't always, they're not open to it always.
No, I mean, I just believe like shared knowledge or like a shared burden is what, I don't know what the saying is.
They're like life is hard, get over it kind of thing.
Yeah, like when you share things, the burden is lessened,
A problem
like,
shared is a problem halved.
Exactly, there
always,
you go.
Always.
I think one of the reasons I'm so like, quite keen to talk about my own like experience of mental health is that I think for me personally, like I've seen a lot of media around like depression or anxiety, but I haven't seen a lot of media that I think touches on my own personal experience of like mania and psychosis, which is like, you know, quite heavy, but like it's interesting, I think, to discuss it because it is, you know, it's out there.
It's out there. It's a really common, it's a really common thing that a lot of people go through all around the world.
Yeah.
And talking about it only helps to understand that better and understand other people better.
And mania isn't something that's really talked about at all.
No. And I mean, well, I've experienced it 4 times.
Yeah.
And it was like pretty serious. Like the Dara you see. Not in the room.
Yeah.
You know, for several weeks at a time.
Oh my gosh.
Like, it is like super, super scary. And I luckily had some angels watching over me being like, okay, we're not going to let her get into real trouble. Yeah. But I was very close to putting myself in like really harmful positions. And I didn't know what was happening, especially not the first time. It's...
You didn't know what was happening as in it's almost like an out-of-body experience?
Yeah, I mean, if you can imagine like the best party high that you've ever had, like a similar, I don't know, like quite, just feels like very intense euphoria and like you've just, you're in control of everything in your universe. It's like, it's very, very surreal and very out of body.
Mm.
And you don't, like reality gets very, very blurry. So like what you perceive to be real is real in that time. And it can be very destabilizing experience, but quite, you know, there is something kind of addictive to it, which is...
It must be kind of, in a way, kind of fun in the moment before it gets scary.
Yeah. It's but like it really, very fun, but very intense. And the come down is just, the other side of it is really hard. So I think like, I haven't seen a lot of, say, like films or TV shows or podcasts that discuss it in a way which I think, that's similar to what...
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there would be people listening to this. Yeah. But
get it out there.
Yeah.
How was your relationship with your bipolar now, a few years on from that especially destabilizing period?
I haven't had an episode since I actually became a chef, which is quite, yeah. look, it took me part of 5 years to find the right medication. That was like
that's a
very significant journey to go on. And then... Essentially, for the year, I haven't had an episode since the year before I moved here. So it's going on 6 or 7 years. I would say the routine and the purpose that the kitchen gives is something which is like so important to my lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I think... Other people who may have had similar life experiences to me, I think we all tend to be quite passionate and quite creative and have a lot to express. And so I think almost I'm channeling a lot of all of my energy into this kitchen and job, which, I mean, it's important to keep it balanced and make sure you give it to other elements of your own personal life. But I think chefing really grounded me. And just ultimately gave me a channel for every facet of my creativity. And it's fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a beautiful thing.
Mm. We're so pleased for you. I mean, it's amazing that you've kind of, it sounds like a long, painful, but very exciting and like brilliant journey of self-discovery.
Yeah. Very full circle. Like it sometimes catches me off guard. Like I feel very lucky and equal parts, like touched and sad. I'm almost having like the experience that my mum didn't have.
Yeah.
You know, she was in a generation that like really didn't understand her mental state. And she didn't understand it herself and couldn't look after herself. So I feel very lucky that like I'm in this generation of time to explore it. But
you're doing it for her.
Yeah. And I think like it's something, you know, when you work in, I think, kitchens, you know, just the nature of the job and the nature of the hours and all the other stuff that comes with it can be quite tricky to manage, you know. Like you can be, obviously, the really late nights and lack of sleep. Like I had doctors be like, you cannot do this. You're going to be averaging like 5 hours of sleep a night. And I really did for a bulk of my early years cooking in London, the early starts and the late nights, like, I was quite worried. I was like, oh, no, I should be sleeping more. But, yeah, if you can make sure you're really looking after yourself, I think it's a wonderful challenge, you know?
Yeah, totally, totally.
Well, speaking of food.
I know.
Shall we?
Yes. It's been staring at me in the face.
It has. So today I've cooked. It was a bit of a, it was a fever dream of a meal that I wanted to make, but it's a braised courgette and Oakleshield tart. So I braised some courgettes for a really long time with loads of olive oil and garlic and thyme. And then I've put those on top of a puff pastry base with creme fraiche and Oakleshield cheese, which I love. It's so, it's kind of funky and it melts really nicely. I have no idea what it's going to taste like. We're about to find out.
Delicious.
We're about to find out. What are we drinking with it, Han?
So today we are drinking a wine from Renegade. Renegade are great. So for anyone that isn't familiar with Renegade, you might have seen the bottles. They all have eyes of, they all have eyes on the label. They're an urban winery based in Bethnal Green originally, but they're now part of a bigger operation in Walthamstow. But what's interesting about Renegade is they don't actually own any of their own vineyards. Instead, they buy grapes from as like far afield as like Germany and Italy, and they freeze them, bring them over to London, and then make the wine here.
Oh. Right.
But this wine is from Essex. So the grapes haven't had to travel so far. Essex Chardonnay, as we all know, England does pretty good sparkling wines now. They also do pretty good still ones.
I don't think I've ever had an Essex wine before.
Oh, well.
I've had lots of Essex and Kent.
Yeah, that Tillingham. I've only had Tillingham wines as my...
So this is fermented using wild yeast, so no kind of like added yeast strains in old oak, so ex-Burgundy and ex-Hungarian barrels, and a little bit of new French oak. And this is just like a really kind of like classic cool climate Chardonnay. We have the same climate that, I don't know, like Champagne had maybe about 20 years ago. So when we've got like similar kind of like limestoney, chalky soils, so... going to be like really cool and zesty and smooth and like a little bit of cream from the, I think it undergoes malolactic fermentation as well. So one thing I really like about the bottles, so the eyes are photographs of people that live in and around East London. They can't be connected to the wine industry. That's the only rule. But every time they make a new vintage of the wine, they get the person to come in a year later to take the photo.
Oh, so, I love that. So you have a real kind of like, a track of somebody's life over the years.
Yeah. So Kyra, who is one half of Little Places London, she is on the sparkling rosé bottle because they make it every year. They're taking a photo of her every single year. So it's quite nice to like watch her get older with the wine. But yeah, let me pour some. I've been talking about it for long enough.
Fabulous.
Sophie, this courgette.
It's courgette delicious.
Lovely.
But in classic recording fashion, it's now a bit cold. But
no, but it's wonderful.
I just love courgette season. I've been so excited about courgette season.
I was actually thinking about courgettes quite late at night.
Oh my God, great. I've tapped into your head.
Yeah, because I've had courgettes a couple of times on the menu so far. Thank you. But I was actually thinking I need to do something else with them because they're so wonderful at the moment.
They are. I just love them so much. My granny's always got like a crazy glut in her garden. And if I ever go and see her in the summer months, she sends me home with like bags of courgettes.
Fabulous.
I'm excited for that day. So this wine and food pairing has happened because Chardonnay, good with cheesy stuff.
Chardonnay is
and I was like, give me cheese.
I know, because there was a bit of a running joke last season that Sophie didn't really know how to make a meal without having a considerable amount of cheese in
it. Everything was cheese-based, everything. And this season I've actually held off till today, so
we're in our salad season. Back
in the comfort zone. Yes. Cheers, Dara. So nice to see you.
Clink. Clink.
Cheers.
Cheers. I can clink you. Clink.
That was a good one.
And it's like,
oh, I like her.
Oh, that's good.
She's so Chardonnay.
Cool, soft. Kind of, yeah. Cool climate buttery. Chardonnay is also going to have this really pleasing palate cleansing effect as well. So
delicious.
Chardonnay had a really bad name for a really long time, and bad Chardonnay is still quite bad, but good Chardonnay is unbelievable.
Good Chardonnay has always been good, but I think it's just because the style of Chardonnay became so popular in America in like the 80s and 90s, like overly oaked, like. Because all the New World, a lot of countries that are patronizingly called New World winemaking countries, it's to do with, so the way that I read someone describing the Old World versus the New World is being the influencer but versus being the influenced.
Yeah.
And because America's young wine scene were like trying to like make wines that rivaled like Bordeaux and Burgundy, and they were like, well, obviously the key to that is oak, so... It seems like a logical argument. They're like, okay, so if the key is oak, then we'll just put like loads of oak chips in the oak barrels to make it like really oaky. And then that's why. And then because those wines became so popular, everyone in the Western world that wasn't necessarily like part of the wine scene was like, oh yeah, so all Chardonnay is like really oaky and creamy and vanilla-y.
We all got confused. We just got a bit muddled.
Anything but Chardonnay. There was even a movement. Everyone hates Chardonnay so much.
You're gonna expose me. I have a wine importer for a dad, and I've been around wine forever and have worked in restaurants with the most incredible wine lists and have had great wine training, but I do not have a mind for retaining wine knowledge. It's actually quite embarrassing. I've now learned how to articulate the flavors that I like, but I get really embarrassed when talking about wine. I can just go silent. I've got nothing to add. And even at wine tasting, we're very lucky at Trullo. We would do a lot of wine tastings as part of our just work life. And I almost feel like I can get so specific with food knowledge, and I love talking about food, but with wine, it's either I like it or I don't. Or like good or not. Like I don't know. I just, I blank.
But all you really need to know.
What you like.
Yeah. I'm finding the vocabulary and the specific words. So like you don't really need to go in and learn the vocab and the terminology around a wine that you're never going to go into a shop and buy. You just need to know what you like.
You need to be able to sit in a restaurant and be like, can I have something that's a bit this?
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because I think my dad a few times has, you know, because his import company is really awesome. It's back in New Zealand and he just imports Italian wines he's got a huge portfolio. Some is very low intervention. A large part of it is low intervention and organic or natural. But he's so passionate about it. And a few times he's been like, hey, you know, one day when you get sick of the kitchen, you know, do you think you're going to want to make the transition into wine and maybe
take over the family business?
I was about to do an accent. I was like, actually, no, my New Jersey accent is shit.
I can do it for you.
Oh,
yeah, my dad
has he retained it?
No, because he actually left. He left the States when he was like 21. He's been gone for a very long time. But my grandma, my nono, and my nono definitely my nono had a beautiful, very New Jersey accent. Every time I call my grandma, it's like Bubbly, you haven't called me for 3 weeks. Like it's very like it's so classic. She's a honey. Bubbly. Yeah.
Where did your parents meet?
So they met in Florence in the 80s, late 80s. My dad, he's a funny one. He was actually studying in Lancaster. He was doing a linguistics degree.
Wow.
I think majoring in like Southern Mediterranean dialects. And anyway, he was in Italy. Even for his studies, he ended up going to the village. My mum is from like the very south of Puglia. She's from a tiny town like as close to the tip of the heel as you can kind of get.
Wow.
Really southern Salento. And he was there for some of his research. But anyway, they were in Florence. My mum broke all the rules and left Florence when she was in her early 20s. Sorry, left Puglia in her early 20s, which as the oldest girl, you're not supposed to do.
Are you supposed to stay in the family until you're married?
Kind of. And even beyond that, like when you're the oldest daughter and she was the oldest of six, she was sort of expected to stay behind and look after her mother and father. And she didn't. She flew and went to Milan and Florence and the family completely cut her off. It was something out of like a novel.
Oh, my God.
So mum and dad met at a party and apparently my dad was baking bread, which actually is something that my dad would do at a party. Mm-hmm. And then they had
the afters making bread.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it past him.
Oh, there's a pun in there as well. I came up with a pun for the coat.
Circle back.
More of like a physical joke. You'd have to see it.
You can go for the camera.
No, I
said
like,
go on.
Like how I'm gonna do it. But it was like just like imagine of like you know like one of the ghosts that has like a head under their arm like pulling a pint. It's like you know no head for me, thanks. There we go.
Wonderful.
That was worth the wait.
It sounds like it took me half an hour to come up with. Actually, it took me 5 seconds.
She's been waiting for a gap in the conversation to come back.
I love it.
I haven't been. I've been like, oh yeah, that's really interesting. Just trying to think of ways to make it circle back to the ghost. Yeah. Okay, and now I'm going to think for the next half hour about DJing and bread making.
Sick. Yeah. It actually didn't take me half an hour. I didn't. 5 seconds. I was going to get back.
That's the most me thing ever. I'm actually really smart. Exposed. It just doesn't seem like it.
Exposed. They had a summer fling. They had like a little, they hooked
tell
up at a party,
more,
basically.
Tell me more.
And then my mum, you know, was staying in Florence. My dad had gone back to England and my mum calls him and is like, hi, so I'm pregnant. Mm. And dad's like, right, well, I'll come get you. And then mum followed him back here to the UK. They didn't really know each other. My mum didn't speak a word of English. They were in Lancaster in winter in the late 80s. My mum must have just been like, what is going on? My sister was born. They moved back to Modena. And then 4 years later, I showed up. And then,
God. That's incredible. Mm.
And yeah, they were married for about 27 years. They ran a restaurant together. I mean, in a, to be upfront, in a very highly dysfunctional manner, as you can only imagine.
Oh, yeah. As all hospitality relationships are. Yeah.
And that's like, that was like another reason I think I was so just frightened by it. I was like, that element of your life doesn't seem to be able to function if you run a restaurant.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like you can really have a family at the same time. But yeah, what was I going to say? Yeah. That's mom and dad.
It's really interesting you say that because my dad actually did, his degree was in hotel catering and management. Okay. He wanted to run a restaurant. And I think he found out at some point during the degree that the highest divorce rates were in hospitality.
Yeah.
And my dad, he's probably listening to this, he is like a family man.
Yeah.
And he was like, I don't want to do it. I want to be a family. Yeah. So he never went into hospitality.
Oh my God.
When that was always his plan.
Look,
so interesting.
It's really like, yeah, I can say it. Like, I've been with my partner like 5.5 years, but like, you know, Wednesday to Sunday, I'm gone from the early morning until the late evening. Like, luckily, he works from home. And like,
what does he do?
So he's been working in like music software for ages. Ooh. But
I've got a software boy too, and you've got a music boy.
I know.
But he's gone back to uni this year to become a psychologist.
We stand a late learning, late in life learning king.
Hey, Marcus. Yeah, he's a legend.
We love you, Marcus. I've never met you before, but you sound like a cool dude.
Love you, Marcus.
But yeah, bless him. Like, you know, it's really it's hard. Like, I'm not really around, and like, I'm never around on weekends. I'm not at the weddings, his friends' weddings. I'm not, you know, like it's.
It's a different lifestyle. You
it
sign
really
up to.
Is. Like when I first moved to London, he because he still works for like a New Zealand company, he like changed his work week so he would have Sunday, Mondays off. So then we always have Mondays together.
That's amazing.
Because he just knew that if his day's off for Friday, Saturday, like I'd just
again, that routine. That routine and that stability, that's what matters.
It sounds like you're finding the ways to make your relationship work in the most functional way possible despite your hospitality hours, which is, you know, I'm sure an amazing learning that you can take from like witnessing the environment that you're growing up in.
Do you know what? That was like one of the reasons I quite liked being at the pub last weekend, sleeping there. Like it was also his birthday and he was like upstairs and it was so nice. I could just like pop up and give him some breakfast and like go back downstairs.
The closeness.
And I actually think like when that weekend was over, I was like, do you know what? Like if that's what I'd have to do in the future, like I don't really think having a family is for me. So I'm not too concerned about figuring all of that out in any, you know, nearby time frame. But at least like thinking about really owning a place where you were going to be there all the time. Mm-hmm. Like if I had a little house behind it,
that would be so
I'd be quite happy.
That's the way.
There's lots of chefs around the world do that. I remember, I feel like it was on was that Ugly Delicious, the episode about like a Korean American family that have a restaurant in LA.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, they've got two young kids. And the restaurant is in front and the house is like directly behind them. And they've sort of built this amazing like sliding door function. Incredible. And the kids are definitely like causing havoc on the floor. And like the other chefs in the show like look kind of stressed out. And I've been in that position where like you're working in a restaurant and the kids of the chef come in and run around. It's like chaotic, but in the best way.
You're I
like,
love that energy. Stay away from I the love knives. That energy.
Yeah, I remember reading, I think it was like a Margot Henderson article, and she was talking about when her kids were really small. And she's like, yeah, I had to go to work and I just put them in the stock pot under the counter. I was like, great. Yes.
Did you exactly. ever make it work?
Yeah.
Did either of you ever read Mrs. Wobble, the waitress, the book? When or am I unlocking a core
that
memory?
Really, really rings a bell, but I can't remember.
So it was those books, and it was like someone who has a job. So it's kind of like learning about jobs, but it also had like a little story behind. So it was Mrs. Jolly's Joke Shop, Mrs. Vol the Vet. They're all misses, but they all had like quite cool jobs. But
respectable lady.
Mrs. Wobble the waitress, she was like wobbly. And like it's got really great images because she wobbles with a roast turkey and then it ends up on a woman's head. She wobbles with a bowl of soup. And then she gets fired from her job, and her husband and her two children are like, oh no, mom, we'll sort something out. And then in the morning, they've transformed downstairs in their home to a restaurant.
Sick.
Is this like tickling? I'll show you the pictures.
Show me the pictures, will do it.
They've transformed downstairs into a restaurant, and she goes, oh, what if I wobble? What if I wobble? And then they get their guests in, and the two kids have got roller skates on and fishing nets. And she goes, what is it? And they're like, oh, you'll see. And she wobbles, and they catch everything, and they're like skimming around on the roller skates. And then, like, the restaurant becomes a big success. And the last line is, but what if I don't wobble? And just like, she didn't cure her wobbliness.
Oh.
It's so cute. Wait, I'll see if I can.
That's how you do it. That's what we want.
The best part, I think, of chefing is the teamwork and the people you're with.
You build such incredible camaraderie with the people that you work with. Yeah, I'm sure that you found, like, moving to a new place, what, a new country on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
You must make friends so quickly.
I mean, that's like,
hospitality.
It's always what I've done. Like every country that I've moved to, I've always worked in restaurants because it's the easiest way to meet people from that city and to kind of get to know the city. So many people come in and you can really, I don't know,
get to know people. You get the vibe quickly.
Yeah. And I've been really lucky. Like every restaurant that I've worked in had a pretty amazing sort of social aspect to it. So I've met lots of people. And yeah, most of my friends also now tend to work in hospitality, and it's nice because you all have the same really crazy sort of days off.
Yeah, that's when it works best, I think.
Yeah.
I think when I worked in restaurants, my problem was that none of my other friends did.
You need
it. So that's
it.
When it feels a bit more isolating.
Yeah.
When you're all in it together, that must feel
incredible. When you've got that like Monday off and you know like a few friends are off and you're like, hey, let's go for lunch.
Yeah.
Like exactly. I really cherish the lunches on Mondays with other chefs. And
where are your favourite Monday eating spots? Because
for industry peeps,
Mondays are classically the day where lots of things are closed.
Yeah, so
where
open
are your favourites?
Mondays. So Noble Rot is open. Mm. I think Brawn's open in the evening.
On those lunches, probably the best value lunch that you can get, like 25 quid for three courses.
Yeah,
Noble Rot.
It's a set menu.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I think it's 20. I was there actually on Monday for Marcus's birthday. I think it's, 22 for two courses and 26 for three.
God, that's incredible.
And it's such a, it's Noble
so
Rot Soho
there.
Is such a beautiful room.
There's still
as
Alex
well.
Jackson.
Yeah. Delicious food. Where else? I quite like venturing to like parts of London that I don't go to too often, and like I'll get a recommendation from either someone that, you know, who I admire and follow recommends for like the other side of the city, or like if I get really chatting to an Uber driver, and I always ask drivers like where their favourite place to eat is.
That's a great shout.
Yeah, I've got them saved in a folder in my phone. I got given a name of an Afghani restaurant quite far out that looks incredible. They've got all this like amazing buffet. Have you been to Afghan Grill?
No.
It is like the other side of the park to you. It
oh,
is
really?
So delicious. We go there a lot on Mondays.
Okay.
Go there. It's literally like on Bethnal Green Road next to.
Oh my God.
Kind of sort of across from where Ippolichi is. Ippolichi is great on Mondays.
Yeah. I guess you must want to eat quite like casual food on your days off. Also food that like doesn't resemble your kind of cooking too much.
For sure.
Right?
Either it goes kind of one of two ways. Either I really want to be in a restaurant and get a bit pampered and drink something really special and eat something really good quality. Something pampered. Like, you know, you just want to be looked after.
You want to be looked after.
Or I just want to be like in a place that resembles a living room.
Yeah.
That's really laid back and I don't have to, you know,
think too much about it. That's what you just want. Enjoy it.
We actually haven't spoken about Polici's yet on the podcast.
I don't think we ever have.
No.
Which is wild.
Polici is the play I've been getting to know. So when I live down the street, I've tried to build a relationship with them for like a good 4 years because my dream is before I leave London to have a pop-up in there.
Yeah.
Really, I've been working. We always chat in Italian. We've got good banter, but I'm working on it one day.
Really?
One day.
They're
going to say yes. I haven't asked the question yet, but if you're listening, Nev, you know.
They do Hindus there.
Yeah.
They'll let you do something there.
I mean, I think of, you know what? I actually have questions for you guys because I like.
I like it when we get quiet.
So like the
intro, I'm flipping the script.
But because we're both on very like, you know, we work in the same kind of industry, but in very different capacities. And I often think about you guys in the media sphere. Me personally, I find social media, and I do all the socials for Tiella, like I find it really overwhelming. And
it's so impressive, can I just say, that you do all the socials all the cooking and all the scheduling and the food ordering and the staff. Yeah. Like that is a massive job.
Yeah.
You're a cool lady. That's mega.
I also do have, like I've got great support both in the pub and in my own staff, but it's a lot. Yeah. I've never been so busy, but I love it.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Girl boss. Gate lights, not gate light.
Hold on,
gas keep.
Don't invade the question. I personally find social media to be such an intense bombardment of stimulus that I personally, and that ever since starting Tiella, I scroll a lot less, I look through stories a lot less because I find it like almost like muddles my brain.
Mm.
And I really, because you know, the two of you, like, and I've got other friends who are kind of in the same sphere as you guys. And I imagine it must be quite a challenge to hold on to your own identity and to hold on to your own ideals in a very intensely saturated world. I don't know how you guys do it.
You're totally right. It is basically. I think we talk about this quite a lot.
We were talking about it earlier. It's kind of like, I think that self-awareness is key. Like at the end of the day, you're just putting pictures on a little app. And so then when we'll say like, I can't believe that we didn't get invited to this. Or I can't believe that like, blah, blah, blah. And then you just take a step out. You're like, God, who the fuck do I think I am kind of thing. I think that because when you get a big following, I think it could be very easy to slip into being a bit egotistical. And I think you have to be a little bit egotistical to do well. Like you have to care about your personal brand and you have to care about how you come across to do
well. Yeah, I'm experiencing that as well on a level. Like I've got people like in the DMs, like really asking questions about my history and my cooking and my family who've come in to eat and who feel like they can take that part of you, but they want to know more.
They feel entitled to that information.
Yeah, and I've been a line cook for the last 5 years, like hidden away in a little kitchen. So I'm almost quite booked out by it, but I'm like, whoa, why do you want to know?
We talk about this as well, like this idea that although it's not the same as going to like a pop-up done by you or a wine club done by me isn't the same as booking a table at a restaurant having a meal. I think some people feel entitled. They feel like that because they've put money in your personal bank account as if you don't have any overheads whatsoever. Yeah. They feel entitled to your time and information about your life, which is fine if you're in the mood to give it. But sometimes,
I think it's interesting as women, like, I have a lot of, obviously the kitchen, the pub is really open. Like we've got the windows open at all times. And like, I can definitely like, sometimes see when people like, you know, I make eye contact with them from the kitchen and it's like a lot of the time I'm in the kitchen, I'm not smiling. Like, yeah, we have a good time, but like I'm quite focused.
You're focused, yeah.
And, you know, I've got...
No one works
managing
like this.
I'm managing a ticket board and also trying to cook and communicate with everyone at the same time. Sometimes I think that people... I feel a need to like always be quite chipper and like almost like be really inviting and like friendly and warm. And it's something that I walk through in life where I'm like, oh, sometimes I just really can't be asked. Or like, I don't have the time for it.
It's the classic, like, smile, love, it might never happen.
Yeah,
thing.
Even...
Yeah. Well, like, people expect it from you, especially as women. I know, don't get me started. Extent, but, like, people expect you to be warm, chirpy, feeling friendly all the time. And you don't always feel friendly. No, sometimes you don't feel friendly.
It's interesting as a chef that like, I've got some suppliers, you know, who I communicate with on WhatsApp who... exclusively will only call me like young lady and sweetheart and poppet and darling, who've never used the word like chef. And then like they'll be in the kitchen dropping off some goods and then like my male sous chef will be there and they're like, oh, hey, chef. And it's just this thing of like
You just, know why I'm in charge.
But you know what? You have to learn to laugh at it. You can't take it personally.
No, totally.
It's actually like if you – my mum was quite – I think she was good and bad at it. But like if you can learn to like have a laugh with it, it stings a little less. But
I mean, what you're saying about the social media thing, like I think – it's basically impossible to not compare yourself to what other people are doing all the time. I think it's the thing that I struggle with the most is not letting what other people are doing cloud how I feel about what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And make me feel like I'm not doing enough or I'm not doing the right kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the main thing that you have to try and do is try and tune out from what other people are doing and not compare yourself to other people.
It's definitely the same.
Which is a near impossible task.
Yeah.
I try and stay off social media for like long stretches of time. Like whenever I go on holiday, I delete Instagram off my phone and I won't look at it. For at least like 3 days of a holiday, I'll just have it. And it's actually incredible what it does for my like feelings of anxiety to not have that stuff clouding me.
Yeah, and just being like, especially, you know, if you like you guys, or even I would say it's a little bit like what I'm doing now, where you merge your personal identity with your professional.
Totally.
Yeah.
So hard not to.
Gets very blurry. But
I think because it's so such a metric focused app as well, you tend to, like, I catch myself doing it. In my head, I'm like, I would never do that. But in, like, so for example, we were having a conversation earlier today and we were like, oh my God, like, I would say, like, oh my God, this person only started doing what they're doing like a few months ago and they've already got more followers than me. And I just stepped back, I was like, who the fuck do I think I am? Do you know what I mean? And suddenly, all of a sudden, you care about this really inane stuff when really, like, okay, fine, like, you don't have as many followers as perhaps like one of your peers does. But yeah, you're right, Sophie. You kind of need to almost like stay in your eye and put the blinkers on, trust in what you're doing because people can smell when you're doing things because someone else has done them.
You got to check in with yourself all the time.
For sure.
Like, who am I doing this for? Who am I doing this for?
It's a bit. I'd say it's a little bit similar to restaurants. Like I haven't been looking at other things friends are posting all that closely, like chef friends. And sometimes I look at other menus. And I definitely have that like momentary comparative analysis where I'm like, oh shit, like. I need to do that and that and that, but it's not worth it, is it?
It just never is. It never is. But it's so hard not to self-flagellate like that.
Yeah.
It's never easy. It's right there.
Yeah.
It's right there.
So there's never been a better time to be a chef. There's never been a better time, so to speak, to be mentally ill, which is great.
Hey, shut up.
There's never been a better time to be mentally ill. Should we do letters? I feel like we've been talking for hours.
I think we should. Ooh. Should we do letters? All right, so letter from an anonymous lady.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Slash man. I shouldn't assume it's a lady. They're basically all ladies.
It's 80%. 80%.
Oh, do you know who you are?
80% woman.
Readership is?
Yeah.
Sick.
It's for the girls.
Hi, ladies.
The girls. How did you overcome fear when setting up your own business?
I didn't.
That's important to say.
I didn't.
That's important to say.
In the weeks leading up to it, I was sat bolt upright in bed, you know, at 3 a.m. thinking about like, oh shit, what if my insurance doesn't come through? And like, what happens if no one comes? And like, I had so many questions. Ride the wave. Like, you've got to obviously be smart and like, you have to have some sense of like know-how about what you're getting into. I don't think that fear like magically goes away. I think you get used to, you just start doing the thing. You get in the rhythm of, it's just business. Like with anything you do in life, it seems so scary at first before you get started. And then when you start doing it, you just get in the rhythm. And I just think if it's, I'm a bit of a, you've probably noticed this by now, but I'm like a little bit, I trust in the fate of the universe a bit. And I was like, do you know what? If this is meant to go well, it's going to go well. And I'll do everything in my power to like, be smart and be a good person and like on a, you know, I was really, one of the biggest fears I had going into this was that I know how difficult it is to run a profitable hospitality business. And we all know it's very difficult to make money in restaurants.
Especially now.
Yeah. And I was really afraid, I think because I had been on the line so for a while up until very recently, I wanted to be able to give my chefs a decent wage. I wanted to give everyone who worked in my kitchen a livable wage. And I was like, shit, man, like that I found really scary. And
it's being responsible for other people as well as yourself. Yeah, is hard.
People's lives. Like, what I would say is that, you know, you have to really trust your intuition and your gut. And you've got to enlist the support of people who are in the same business you're going to go into. One thing I'm proud of myself for doing, when I got to London, I set out on making good connections with people in the industry here. So working in kitchens, I was at Rubedo in Stoke Newington, you know, working Wednesday to Sunday, and we didn't have, you know, I didn't have a lot of time off. So I was like, I need to meet people. I need to make friends with chefs because I want to get to know the city. And I worked hard at it, like worked hard at like getting to know people and making those sorts of connections. And I feel very grateful that going into the pub, I could call on my friends who have done the exact same thing I'm doing and asking for help. But, you know, be clever, trust your gut, you know, express your concerns with people around you. But also, like, it's life. Fucking take a plunge. Like, I tend to live my life by the high risk, high reward motto.
Yeah.
I don't think that life in the safe lane gets you the big treats.
Totally.
That's just me.
I feel like you have to put the work in and also fear. Sounds a bit Kim Kardashian. Get off your ass and work.
Get off your fucking ass.
Get off your ass
and work.
And work. But like if you put the work in, I feel like fear is reduced. Fear comes when you feel really unprepared.
Yeah.
And the more work you put into feeling prepared for something, you get to reduce that fear.
All my genuine nightmares are from feeling underprepared.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I spent like, you know, people like, wow, this Taylor's going so great. You must be so happy. And da, da, da. Like, yes, I am. But I also worked really hard in the lead up. I spent months and months and months writing out lists on lists, planning menus. I spent months getting to know chefs who I thought would make a great team, you know, putting together the pieces. Like you do have to, you got to really push yourself, but then also take a leap.
Yeah.
Great advice.
I risk, high reward.
Great Hope advice. That helps.
Thank you so much for the Instagram Reel soundbites. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Oh, this is a good one. What would you say the best birthday gift is for somebody who loves cooking? Any thoughts, Han?
I really want a rice steamer.
I was going to say...
great present.
I was going to say buying a piece of kit that's like really like long lasting.
And mind blowing.
Yeah, like I got given a Creuset for my 30th and it just is like one of the most precious things I own. Or if you can pull it off, I think lessons with like, if you can get like a cooking lesson, like I don't really know if this exists that much, but like if you can get a cooking lesson with like someone great or some cooks that know their culture's food really, really well and that it's difficult to learn the secrets and tips and tricks, like I think cooking lessons are awesome and really fun, but also I don't think you can beat like a trip away to like a really good culinary destination.
Yeah,
if you can pull
totally.
That off, I think like being like, hey babe, we're going to San Sebastian for the weekend. Like if Marcus did that for me, like I'd love that.
Yeah, Cam, are you listening?
Yeah.
I took Cam to Paris for like 36 hours in Paris as a Christmas present. We like got the Eurostar booked to my hotel and then went to like 6 restaurants.
Yeah.
Oh my
it was
God.
The
That's
best
the most
time.
Expensive Christmas present.
I didn't
I've
pay
ever
for
heard.
All the restaurants. I just paid for the hotel and the trains, in fairness.
On,
but I planned it, you know.
Yeah, I think something like that or like a beautiful knife.
Beautiful knife.
Yeah,
or even, do you know, a beautiful chef's knife. But one of my most useful bits of cooking kit, if you want a lower budget, is a small serrated tomato knife.
Yes.
Like those little
Victorinox ones. The Puglia is a non-knife. Do you know if you go to Puglia, and you're looking for a knife, my love, you're only going to find a small serrated knife. Like, I've just got visions of my nonna, like, slicing garlic in her hand. Like, that's how all the pugliese and nonnas, like.
I love that. It's,
you only use it for everything.
But they work for everything. They stay sharp forever. You don't need to sharpen them. Yeah. And they do everything perfectly. Like, it is. I think they cost, like, $4.99 or something.
Yeah, or a good, like, even a really good quality peeler. You know how peelers can be really shit?
An OXO Y peeler.
Yeah.
That was a big long
That's
list.
A good selection.
Although I don't know how I'd feel, like, out of context, if I opened her parcel and saw, like, a £4.99 knife, I'd be like, that's
I think that's for someone who is maybe it's like a secret Santa present or something, you know? Or, like, as an ensemble of other presents.
But it is, it's also, it's funny because it does touch on, like, our perception sometimes in food that it's got to be of high financial,
yeah, like monetarily, you gotta spend
for it to be good. When actually, you get 10 chefs in a room, and they're all going to tell you their best meals or their best experiences. You know that they, by and large, they're not happening at like the 3 Michelin starred places. They're experiences which touch the soul,
like
you saying small serrated knife, like that. Yeah. To me,
it
like,
gets you somewhere.
If someone gave me a small serrated knife, like who knew me, I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, you get me. You get me.
You know, because that's really like, you know, that's where the heart of food is. Like, I don't know.
It's not the fancy stuff.
The fancy stuff is great. But it's the stuff that like hits home, and home is different for everyone. But I think we all look, you know, when I set out doing Tiello, I was like, I just want to nurture people. Like I want people to show up at the pub and feel like they had their grandma, like, give them a plate of food. And, the reason I was so excited about the pub is that, like, pubs are to the UK what a trattoria is to Italy. Very comfortable places that, like, you go and you just feel relaxed and, like, you're not putting on airs, you know?
It's just casual but really formative.
And I think now the way that it's going with food, like, we see with all the media that's come about, whatever, about the menu or... You know, the media that's coming out, which is picking
apart. Post-capitalism hospitality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean like.
Like your anti-Noma movement.
Yeah. I personally always look for dining experiences which make me feel hugged and like.
They can feel quite cold. I think in the past wee while, and me and Sophie have been talking about in the previous podcast about how spoiled we've become because of like, I don't really feel the mood to go out and eat some lovely, delicious food. But it's like those really high, fine dining experiences, which while they're amazing and once in a lifetime, they can feel very cold.
Cold is so the word. It doesn't leave you feeling nourished.
No, and I've always had that. I've always felt that because like in the restaurant that I grew up in, it was like, I remember, you know, mum would go up to tables and, you know, she'd notice a little bit of sauce at the bottom of the plate and be like, oh, let me bring you some bread. Or, you know, notice a glass that's got a little bit, oh, come on, let me just, it's on the house, let me give you a little tipple. Like those extensions of hospitality. Like I often go clear the plates in the garden at the pub. You know, if I've got a minute, I like to see who's on the tables and see what's left on the plate. It's actually research for me. And I saw the other night I was putting a dish down on a table. And they were finishing off a pasta and it was like a meat, you know, Sunday sugo kind of sauce. And I said, oh, let me get you a slice of bread. Do you want to do a little scarpetta? And they're like, oh, thank you. And it's like, I could have charged them $3.50, but you know, I know that there's a piece in my bread tray in the kitchen that's going slightly stale.
Yeah.
And that's like,
everybody wins here. Everybody wins.
Like hospitality is such a reciprocal act. You know, it depends on the...
You both rely on each other. Like the chef relies on the customer. But I feel like it's almost a lot of the discourse lately about hospitality has been very like chef versus customer. And it's kind of like insane, isn't it?
I actually like... I was reading this piece in Eater last night. Eater, I think, US.
Yeah, I was going to say.
This chef who I forget his name, but he's, you know, a bit older, like quite a big name in Mexican food apparently. But he was talking about like why he didn't like the new season of The Bear and the old season of The Bear. And he's sick of seeing a portrayal in kitchens of the angry, abusive, belligerent chef. And I completely agree. Like, look, what makes good TV is what makes good TV. Mm. And, you know, that's a whole other beast. But like... It's a beautiful business, and it's a beautiful transaction that relies on humans getting together and doing the most simple and really archaic of acts, which is like breaking bread. And like, yes, obviously there's like a transaction of money. Like, yeah, there's a lot of layers to it.
But it doesn't mean there's still not like genuine human warmth and love in it.
And exactly that, like, you know, I do think it's the responsibility of a diner to, when they're going into a place, to give hospitality back to the people that are looking after them. Because I think it's a great, it shows a great deal of like lack of self-awareness. If you show up to a place and you're rude and you're a bit pushy and you get something back from the servers that maybe you didn't want, well, it's a two-way street.
So you've
come
here to eat. Like, yeah, like you're not doing us a favor. Yeah. Like, you've come here to eat. Like, we're doing you a favor.
Exactly. You're in our house. And I kind of behave like that a little bit, where I'm like, buddy, I know better than you. Like, they always talk about like small plates as it comes menus. It's sharing. Listen up, buddy. There's a reason why kitchens do that. The reason is that kitchens operate on really lean labor pools. One chef is on average doing the job of three people. The reason why we do as it comes and sharing is because it's the easiest way for our kitchen to pump up the food at the pace that we need to pump out the food to turn a profit to make our restaurant survive. Yeah. So I get really annoyed when I see these memes and I'm like,
we've got to use that on Instagram. We've got to get people mad.
It's also the nicest way to eat.
Yeah.
It's also like shit.
It's nice.
I find the act of going to a restaurant and having starter, main, put each, where nobody interacts with each other's food,
it's so antisocial.
Bizarre. Can I also say for the record that your small plates are very generous?
Thank you.
It's not like, oh, should we have like a quarter of a piece of asparagus each? That's not the vibe.
Look,
Tiella is generous.
Yeah, I also think because I do think that some restaurants get a bit carried away with portion sizes. Me personally, I don't. Like, I like to make sure people are eating abundantly.
Hearty.
So I do think some restaurants have to hear it. But maybe I've now been I'm going to get blocked.
Dara, thank you so much. Your conversation has been so insightful, amazing, revealing.
And it's felt so enriching.
Enriching. We've come away and we feel, you know, when you sometimes talk to people and you're like, oh, I've talked to you and I feel so energized.
I feel pumped.
Ditto.
Pumped.
Oh, aww, baby. Is there anything you would like to plug?
Tiella. My restaurant.
You must.
Can you please come to Tiella? The Compton Arms. Also plug the Gun, like our sister pub. If you like a boogie and you're near Victoria Park, go to the Gun. What else? I can't think. I've had a few glasses of wine now. And now come to my restaurant. There
glad
you go.
To be of service. Yeah.
I'm literally going tonight. That's so funny. I am going tonight. See you there.
Yay.
Sophie, is there anything you want to plug?
I've got some events coming up. I think I said that in the last episode.
I think
also,
I'm about to say the exact same thing.
I've got some events coming up, so keep your eyes peeled on my Instagram for some announcements of those. I would love to feed you and see you there.
So do I. I also have some events coming up, probably in the week that this comes out, or it's just been, so there's any other tickets that you can get your little mitts on, grab them. But otherwise, please leave us a review and a 5-star rating. If it's any less than 5 stars, we don't want to know. I think people actually genuinely take that advice. There's like someone rated it 1 star. I was like, you're just weird.
We're having a bad day.
I would accept a 4. Sometimes we're anxious and we like don't talk about things in a very interesting or fun way.
Okay. A learning opportunity for you. Like when I get a bad review.
Yeah, totally.
It's an opportunity.
Yeah. So I take on board that my energy wasn't good that day.
Thank you.
Thank you for your insight, listener.
Okay. Thank you for your service. 5 or 4-star review we will accept. You do not know how much it means to us. Plus, it means that we can make more podcasts. We're more likely to get sponsors. And it just like works out better for everyone. If you enjoy this podcast and you've listened to this episode, then that probably means that you're very keen on helping us create more episodes. I've also had 2 glasses of wine.
Gorgeous.
Not so much food. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks,
and see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.